Hello and welcome to Effective Conversations with Yael Finer. Each episode is a unique journey into a polarizing topic where we go beyond the facts, explore the underlying emotions, and learn something new about ourselves.
Today, I'm talking with Dr. Peter Wood. He is a climate activist with a PhD in forestry, which he obtained to fight the industry on its own terms. He has been warning us for years about the impact of logging practices on floods and fires. A lot of his warning came true in British Columbia in the summer and fall of 2021. We talk about the conflicts around ancient forests and the year-long blockade at Fairy Creek. We discuss the confusing terms used by the industry and why they don't mean what we think they do. This confusion is deliberate, and the following conversation should clarify things. Hi Peter, and thank you so much for being here. I want to ask you about something that confuses me. When I see that the logging company declares that they're having sustainable practices, and they got approval from their own environmental expert, but at the same time, other environmental experts that learned at the same forestry schooling are saying that clear cutting in this specific area is an ecological disaster. So my question is, how do we know what is true, what is really environmental and what is not? And how do we get a polarized opinion from people that learned at the same school?
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. I think it's important to understand like the origins of the faculty and of the profession. And if you go back to, over 100 years ago to when the first forestry schools in Canada started developing, and they were really premised on the German model of what we now know as, you know, sustained yield forestry model. So what that is looking at how do you manage to make sure that set level of volume of wood is produced on a regular basis, and how do you make sure that's constant over time? And when this was first conceived of in Germany, long time ago, it was seen as being very progressive because it was in contrast to previous models where, you know, we were just cutting down our forests and converting them often to agriculture, or basically without any concern for the future, we just were cutting them down. So sustained yield forestry was the first attempt at saying, okay, we're going to try to maintain a volume of wood coming out of the forest at an optimal, efficient rate. And this was based on, you know, second, third growth forests where things were very simplified. They were not looking at, you know, trying to maintain any other values than the wood volume. So things like biodiversity and other, you know, ecosystem services were not there yet. And I think it's important to consider that, you know, a lot of our origins of a faculty of forestry, such as UBC, were sort of that often lies at the core still. And the subsequent modernization of the faculty and of the profession and of our understanding of forestry has been like a layer over top of that. So as societal values have said, no, we want you to look after biodiversity values, and we want to look after water values, increasingly looking now at the functions around climate and carbon sequestration, all of those have been added not as a new or separate paradigm that puts those first, but as a layer over top of what is ultimately still based on sustainable production of wood products. And as a PhD student in the Faculty of Forestry, I often felt that there is a lot of people trying to change the faculty towards incorporating some of these new and more modern interpretations of what sustainable management is, but it would come up against the dominant view of that original view of sustained yield forestry, where we're trying to optimize the efficient production of wood. And so my experience in a faculty of forestry, whether it be University of Toronto, where I did my PhD, UBC, where I spent my undergrad, as well as some time as a visiting scholar while writing up my PhD, I was always interested in that tension, because there's a lot of different types of people in a faculty of forestry these days. And if you look at UBC, you know, they've got an entire, you know, program dedicated to looking at Indigenous forestry
practices.
And Indigenous practices, entire department that just looks at community forest management. They've got, you know, the entire third floor, you know, is looking at biodiversity and conservation, hydrology, you know, streamside riparian zone ecology. There's all that. And then on another floor, you might have an entire department that is looking at engineering. So they look at, like, when you take engineered wood products, so, you know, looking at composite sort of, you know, products that glue a lot of strands of fiber together to make these bigger products. So that's also in forestry, right? You have biochemical engineers that look at, you know, how can we make substitutes for skin, like actual human skin can now be made out of these cellulose products derived from wood that, say, for like a burn victim that needs new skin, they can now make this out of wood cellulose. So it's just boggling the amount of different types of people that would all consider themselves in the faculty of forestry. And so, yeah, it's very interesting, but at the same time, there is in the background, you know, where a lot of the funding comes from is always going to play a role in what the focus of the research is, who gets rewarded, where there's grants available will tend to guide the research. So I think that it's a faculty of what we call strange bedfellows. So it's an odd mix. It's a bunch of people that find themselves together under the same roof, but they actually don't have a lot in common, or they have one thing in common. They can all say, we agree that, you know, forestry should be sustainable and that we should make lots of interesting products out of it. But then after that, it's like, well, there's a varied response you'd get in terms of what kind of societal values are we managing for? Who gets to decide, right? Is it the level of importance of, you know, First Nations responsibility, local community control, protection of old growth versus management of second growth? You know, you're going to get very different answers from different people in that faculty. So I find it fascinating.
And the word sustainable is used differently. Sustainable,
that's right.
Forest ecosystem or sustainable, I can log more time.
That's it.
Right.
That's it. So, and I think that's really key, is that the word sustainable is kind of mushy enough. It's so poorly defined, or it can be interpreted in so many different ways, that it allows for people to all say that they want it, and it allows for people to all agree on that's a thing that we are moving towards, but at the same time have completely different results. And so, you know, there's a tension there when it comes to, you know, with the Fairy Creek, you know, situation coming to a head right now, and old growth logging in BC in general, that's where the rubber hits the road. It's like, okay, if you think that logging the last 3% of this type of forest, this very large old growth that we have very little of, if you think that we can achieve sustainability in logging that last 2.7%, well, that's a very different interpretation of what I feel is sustainable. And so that forces the conversation to a place that can otherwise be, you know, we can kind of pretend like we agree. In reality, there's not that much agreement.
So you say pretend we agree, that BC government say all kinds of things. Yes, we want sustainable old growth. We're going to protect the old growth, but they mean something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have shown in a number of different initiatives going back to, you know, even in the 70s and the 80s, there is talk about, you know, the need to, you know, to harvest more sustainably. There was an awareness there. There was an old growth review that took place. There was a commission, the Pierce Commission. Even going back to after World War II, there was a commission called the Sloan Commission. And
what is it?
S-L-O-A-N. It was the name of...
What is the commission?
It's like an inquiry. Like the government says, we have a potential problem. We need some smart people to investigate and see, you know, a possible solution. And so we've had various commissions over time. So Sloan Commission, Pierce Commission, there's, you know, the whole Clackwood Sound scientific panel. I mean, we love to do commissions. We love to do studies. They just announced one yesterday. A new old growth review is going to study the problem more. This is over and above the old growth panel review that was conducted by Gary Merkel and, you know, his co-author. And there's just this tendency to avoid making difficult decisions by studying things more. So in the meantime, in the course of when all of those studies happen, we just continue to lose our old growth. Yeah. And so the options available to us become more limited as we do more and more studies. We're kind of running out of time to be able to protect what remains. Yeah. So that develops a certain amount of cynicism amongst citizens, because, you know, if you did that once, we would be skeptical. But you do it like five times and it's beyond skeptical. It's just like, no, we don't believe you anymore. We know that you're going to keep logging while you do your study. So, yeah, that's it.
And it's different governments and still doing the same.
Yeah, right? Different governments have done similar things. And it really speaks to the power of the industry that they can hold a fairly constant policy on how we regulate the forest, no matter who's in government. They get a pretty consistent approach to, you know, matching with what they would like to see. And that includes, you know, at the highest level, that's tenure. So do you know about tenure and tenure systems?
Yeah, but explain it to maybe people don't know.
Sure. So tenure systems is how we allocate the forest harvest to companies. It's done through a system where you either through a volume-based system, so companies get allotted a certain volume per year, or you have sort of geographically specific area, like a TFL or a tree farm license. And you can kind of tell just in the name that we call it a tree farm. It's not a forest, it's a tree farm license. It is something, you know, it's a little telling there that we have, that's kind of the worldview reflected in a name. So that tree farm license, TFL, those allocations are the big decisions, right? Those are happening long before we have, you know, a conflict over a specific cut block. Long before that happened, we had major allocations of public land to private companies for a given length of time, 10, 15 years. They're typically renewable. And so after 15 years or so, they can go up for renewal and have a license again to keep harvesting. And this would be in contrast to the American system, right? In the American system, it's mostly private land. So there's private land owners are in control of the private lands, aside from, you know, the national forest lands. But in Canada, we're the opposite. We're almost entirely public land. But that public land is...
We're talking about 96% public land, right?
That's right. Yeah, very, very high proportion. And that's the big picture. And I think it's important to understand that as we look at a specific area, it all happens in that context where we have given a lot of power and a lot of control over public land. And we often forget it's public land because it's so tightly controlled by the private industry. But just to say that within that context, we find ourselves often at the mercy of these very powerful, increasingly fewer number of very large and very powerful companies. And this is a dynamic reflective of the global south. Okay, so I have some experience working in the Congo Basin, as well as in Borneo. But we can see this model of very big allocations of concessions, you know, million hectares or so, and allocating that public land to a very, very powerful, very politically influential company. So that's a model that we share with countries like I've worked in before in Cameroon, for example. And typically we see this reflective of a developing country. So Canada is probably most tightly resembling a developing country in the way that we behave. So that is often reflective of having very poor governance in some of these countries. In areas like Cameroon is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And so the typical way that the logging allocations of concessions, it often is, it involves some very murky politics of favors, political favors being exchanged, high risk of corruption. So that's on my mind when I look at how BC behaves. It's like, wow, we actually are very similar in the way that we seem to be very beholden to these powerful logging interests, even as, you know, 85% of British Columbia is saying, stop the old growth logging. We still see the willingness of governments from all political stripes, well, that have taken power to defy that public will and to continue to reward the industry. And so that's very risky. So what they need to do in order to make that palatable or to mitigate the political backlash that could come from completely ignoring the public's will on this is they have to make it sound nice. And so that has created a very booming industry around being able to spin very unsustainable logging to be able to portray it as sustainable.
You're talking about the core of the confusion now. And that it's not so innocent mistake that it's so hard to understand what's really going on.
That's right. So the entire industry has sprung up since the 90s around portraying the BC lumber industry as being a sustainable industry. I used to work for the Ministry of Forests when I was just out of undergrad. I think I was about 23 at the time. And I got a job with the Trade and Sustainable Development Unit working for, which was at the time, it was NDP government, just prior to the Liberals' 16-year reign. And in the aftermath of Clackwood Sound and all the protests, BC was under a lot of scrutiny from the markets to be able to demonstrate that their wood was produced in a sustainable way. So there's a lot of interest in forest certification, and there was an attempt by NGOs, Indigenous people, to create this label, the Forest Stewardship Council certification program, a global program with regional and province-specific standards. And so that was a real threat to BC. If we were going to be held to this very high standard, potentially not being allowed to log or log as much in old growth, requiring free, prior, and informed consent from Indigenous people. So they were quite worried about that. So the industry has created their own system. They created the Canadian Standards Association, CSA, Sustainable Forest Management Standard. And they wanted to create a system that they could certify quite easily the status quo. So they really wanted to get recognition of existing government law and government levels of consultation were adequate. And the US did the same with a US system called the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. And again, this is an industry-led system that really just wanted to make sure that FSC program, which was requiring big changes in order to get certified, they would have another program that they could certify quite easily, and then the market would not be able to differentiate. That's right.
Yeah.
And so what originally, you know, companies like Home Depot and IKEA were saying, okay, we are committing to buying only certified products. Then when all of a sudden there was the introduction of many, many, many different systems of certification, it was perfect. It was confusing, and the industry kind of won, to be honest. Looking back now, 20 years after I've started this, they've been very effective in getting their certification system accepted as equivalent, even though on the ground, a number of reports have revealed that it is very different in terms of the performance of the companies that are certified. And a more, you know, recent and relevant example of that would be the Teal Jones's TFL-46 is, you know, that's certified sustainable and is marketed as such. You go to their website, they've got a lot of great looking web pages talking about the sustainability of their operations. But I've reviewed their forest management plans, and they clearly show that over time, like the amount of old growth has gone from, you know, about 80% or so down to under 10% left, and it continues to go down. And yet they would say that that's sustainable. CSA has certified it. So I've done an analysis of their standards by which they certify, and there's nothing in there that you could really hold somebody to. It basically is like self-certification system. So it says, you know, you set your own standards for you to achieve. And it even is written in there. It says, if you're not meeting your standards, like if you're regularly finding it hard to meet your standards, say for like maintaining biodiversity or other values, that you should just change them and make them easier for you to meet. Because why not? Because there's actually nothing, you know. Yeah. So it's very fascinating.
You are the law, so you can decide what you want to do.
That's it. And you can, and speaking of you are the law, another big move that happened over the last 10-15 years was this switch from really relying on government as the authority, right? Government is the regulator. Government goes out and audits and checks up on companies, and they can put fines on them if they are doing the wrong thing. There's been this shift towards kind of self-regulation. So companies have been increasingly given the power under professional reliance to assume that the professionals involved, like the registered professional foresters, the RPFs, registered professional biologists, RP bios, you know, they're given a lot of authority now to be making these assessments. And so it really is a shift from government having that power to the company themselves kind of self-assessing, or they hire like a consultant. And so the contractor or the consultant is hired on the basis of doing that review. And so if you're a consultant that wants to stay in business, you're competing against other consultants, and you're probably not going to get picked to do a job if they know that you're one that holds a very hard line on those rules and regulations. So we've seen quite a bit of backlash to that. The NDP government has made some moves to address that, but I haven't seen any fundamental shifts yet in increasing government's role. I personally would like to see government play a very strong role and reassert themselves as being a regulator of the industry. But I think it has to come from outside the current paradigm. So just going back to your original question about the School of Forestry, that is a very specific way of viewing the world. Through the lens of a forester, we have a very specific type of sort of worldview that is going to guide not only how we view the forest, but also in just like the relationships, right? There's a certain type of relationship between RPFs, the registered professional foresters, a certain kind of language and understanding and priorities and values that it's a culture to be sort of aware of. And I think that if we really want to prioritize other values, such as biodiversity, ecosystem function, climate, we need people from those professions. We need ecologists, and we need not a forester with some ecology training over top of that, but somebody who has first and foremost a view to maintaining the health of an ecosystem. And then after that is taken care of, looking at what type of volume of wood can we remove and not compromise the health of the forest, the ecosystem functions. But that is what we were talking about when we talk about a paradigm shift. And that paradigm shift has been called for by the most recent old growth panel review, but it's been backed up by a number of other studies that have been done in the past, as well as a number of the leading thinkers on this really agree that if we're going to get out of this current situation, we need to shift our mindset. And that is not necessarily going to come from within the current paradigm and the professions that to date have been associated with how we've arrived at the current situation that our forests are in.
I can't agree with you more on that, that only a deep shift in mindset and the worldview will cause a real shift in the way the industry works. Without the real change, we will keep seeing fake market responses to the public complaint. Yeah, the other thing I wanted to ask you is about the different numbers that are being presented about how much old growth forest is left. The last report was saying 2.7% old growth forest left, but the industry is saying no, there is 30% old growth forest left. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and so the primary confusion is around conflating numbers that are associated with the total amount of old forests compared to the amount of that that's actually interesting to the logging industry. And that also coincides with some of the biggest and best and tallest and some of the most biologically intact and diverse forests. So this is typically, this has been the low valley, so low elevation, valley bottom forest. So you can imagine in a drainage, mountains on either side, you've got a situation where the nutrients and the growing potential and the microclimate, like the water and the temperature, sunlight, it's all just perfect in that valley bottom. And they tend to produce some of the biggest trees, very large trees, of course. You can picture there's no branches for the first, few dozen meters. So this gives this beautiful wood that doesn't have any knots in it. That's right. And so that's like the best of the best is, you know, our old growth valley bottom, cedar and Sitka and, you know, hemlock and Douglas fir. And so this is also often associated with on the coast being close to, you know, very easily transportable, very accessible by water. And it also exists in the interior as well, within the temperate rainforest that exists in the interior. So that accessible stuff at low elevation was the first to go, right? That's the cheapest to log and the highest value, and also coincided with some of the most desirable land to settle on, right? Like the east coast of Vancouver Island, for example, all that Douglas fir forest is gone. We're down to, you know, 1% there of the Douglas fir coastal type of forest there. So what happened then is like, it's a bit like as we've gone after minerals like gold, or as we've gone after oil, we went after the easiest stuff first, right? And as oil reserves have run out in the easy to find stuff, we've increasingly gone after more and more extreme sources of oil. And now all of a sudden the, you know, Alberta tar sands are economically viable because the price of the barrel of oil keeps going up. So it becomes more viable to go after extreme sources. And same with gold and other things. It's more extreme. And so, you know, some of the old growth logging I've seen, you know, in the north of Vancouver Island, for example, oh my goodness, it's incredible. It's so steep. It's very extreme mountainous conditions that they are required to go in and get. But it's worth it to them now when the price of old growth is continuing to go up, reflecting the scarcity, because we can't get to these low valley old growth bottoms anymore. So we are increasingly going further and further afield. We're doing more extreme logging to get that volume. But to go back to your original question, you know, we really have to make this difference between the old growth that is commercially viable, that's this big, especially on the coast, this large site potential.
Can you explain commercially viable? Yeah.
Things that make money, trees that make money, more money. Whereas a lot of the old growth, you know, it can be in areas that are, you know, on rocky areas, the trees don't grow very big. It can be in a swamp. So, you know, in a swamp, the trees can be look like bonsai trees. They're very short. You can have trees growing at the top of the mountain that after 200 years, the trees are only a couple meters tall because they're most of the year they're under snow and ice. Often the government will include those not commercially interesting areas, but they'll say, well, we've got this much old growth. And it means that number is very inflated. And so when you hear the scientific studies that came from Rachel Holt and associates, they really unpacked that. They said, okay, well, let's look at these different types of old growth. And what the public is concerned about is these very large site potential site series that are much, much more valuable than...
So why are they more valuable for us, for the citizen? Why we need those kind of old growth and not the one that's in the swamp?
They're valuable for many reasons. They're valuable for biodiversity, for water, for preventing landslides, from providing a microclimate, fish. And that's not even before you start talking about the human values and the First Nations values for that area. But overall, the important thing is that there's 3% left. So the question is not, should we stop logging? That's not the question. We're not talking about, should we stop logging? The question is when we will stop logging, because
those specific old growths,
because we have 3% left. You only can have a few choices there. You can stop logging when you're done, when you've logged to zero, right? That's kind of the default scenario right now, is if we continue on the current trajectory, we will go down to zero. That's outside the very small amount that's in protected areas. And then we have the potential to stop now at 2.7 or so percent. But there's no other options there, right? Like it's not a question of if we should stop, but when and how much.
Very tiny window. Yeah.
We have a tiny window and we have a choice to make. And that's what I would, you know, ask anybody that says, oh, we can't stop logging, I would just say, you know, like, tell me a number. Tell me a number that you think should be left available for other things other than logging when we finally make that transition to logging sustainably within the 97% of that type of forest that has already been logged. So we have a real decision to make here. And I think what people need to understand is we are making a decision even when we don't make a decision, right? By not choosing to say proactively, like, how much we want to have left, we've made a decision to continue towards zero. And so I think it's really important to force that conversation and get them to say that. Say, we are planning on logging until there's zero. And whereas we're saying we want to log until, like, there's 2.7%, they've chosen a number and that number is zero, right? And that's a different conversation. If I'm talking to a logger on the road and we're having a conversation around what should happen with this forest, you know, I would say, look, we need to think about this in terms of, we want permanent communities that are viable on Vancouver Island and the interior. What do we need to have a permanent community here with permanent employment, with permanent forests that can support all of that, right? And that requires a longer term view where we move from this depletion, like counting down that number until we get to zero, and instead looking at how we can get the most out of that 97% of the land that has already been logged. And so that's a tougher thing to do, right? That's a tougher strategic exercise.
And mind shift. Yeah.
And mind shift. But we can do it. We're smart people. We can, we've done more difficult things than that. It just requires some effort. It requires strategy. It requires leadership. It's going to require making some tough decisions, but it also, on the other side of that, offers so much potential to move beyond this conflict to really talking about how we can make the most of the industry, how we can build a more value-added sector, how we can get more value per cubic meter, more jobs per cubic meter than we currently do. We rank very, very poorly in terms of how many jobs per tree that we create in BC, even compared to Ontario. I think it was Ontario has like five times the number of jobs associated per cubic meter, like a volume of wood. And that's because they have all the higher end manufacturing. It's going into looking at making hardwood floors or looking at manufactured products that are very, very high value that require specialized skills as opposed to raw log exports and very low value commodity products.
I didn't get that. We have less people working per cubic meter because...
We tend to produce things that don't require a lot of work. Mm. So, yeah. So when with some things, you know, if you're producing guitars and furniture and cabinets and, you know, all these things that require a lot of careful craft.
Skills,
right? The amount of dollars that have to be paid out in terms of employment to get to that finished product is much higher. Where again, this is where we start looking a little bit more like a developing country in the in our resource model. We are very dependent on exporting very low levels of processing and low value added products, and we are exporting that, and the jobs
to China,
are actually.
Right?
We have most of our products, the bulk of it still goes to the U.S. We have a huge trading relationship with the U.S., but increasingly China has played a role, Japan, Europe as well. But I think at last I checked, it was always hovering around 50% to the U.S., you know, a lot to the U.S. housing market. It's really fascinating. The university's pension plan, my father was a university professor, okay, at UBC, and he told me that the university was so heavily invested in forestry companies, the pension plan, that the professors would look to the U.S. housing market to see how the U.S. housing market is doing, how many new starts are they building new houses, because that would tell them whether the price of wood would be going up, and in turn, whether the stock prices of that the pension was invested in would be doing all right. So if you're talking about a paradigm shift, I mean, there's a very deep relationship here between the university and the forest industry. And yeah, I think that really has to be taken into consideration. But just going back to talking about value-added products, like, again, who's fighting for that, right? We have a very powerful lobby here that's very effective in pushing for policies that are favorable to very large industry, right? And so everyone talks about wanting to build a value-added second growth industry, but I don't really see anybody that's pushing for that, that's a big lobbyist that could stand up to the very powerful sort of big companies. Again, going back to the tenure system where we've got this really tight control of big chunks of land that have been allocated to big companies, you know, that really sets the context for which, you know, if a company wants to do something local, value added, mm-hmm. say they want to build, you know, local prefabricated homes out of wood. They just want to get a small amount of volume. It's incredibly difficult to get access to be able to buy logs on the open market because it's so controlled by the big companies and the big mills. And so it's a real struggle to try to even try to do something different. We have a lot of momentum, inertia. I don't know how you want to describe it, but we're set in a certain way. And there's very powerful interests that have every interest in keeping it going in that direction. So change can feel difficult. There will be winners and losers if we want to change.
I want to ask you about the second old growth forest. Do we have those forests in BC? Because I haven't seen many of kind of middle-sized tree, I imagine, to be a second growth. And how many years it takes those forests to become commercially viable? And is it worthwhile for the industry to invest to create those forests? And also, I want to ask you if you can give us a zoom into a mindset of a logger standing in a blockade, let's say standing to go to work in Ferry Creek, so obsessed to go to work and do their job. And why not themselves? Because there are people that love forests, they know the forest, they live around forests, they're part of the community. Why won't they want to protect those ancient trees for their own good sake, for their own kind of future and children and their own community? What is the mindset? Why can't they say, tell the employee, send me to work in another place, send me to work in a second growth forest, for example?
There's a couple things there. First, I would say is understanding that when you're entering into a forest that's never been logged before, you know, it may have been managed very sustainably by the First Nations for thousands of years, but overall, it still is in a condition that reflects natural evolution of that forest over 10,000 years, right? So the tree itself, if you're looking at like an old growth red cedar that's between 5 and 800 years old, There's trees as old as, 2,000 years in some situations. But say if we're looking at a 500 to 800 year old red cedar, which is very average for a coastal red cedar. So we're looking at not a 500 year old tree, but we're looking at a 10,000 year old ecosystem, right? And so the value that's in that tree reflects 10,000 years of investment, 10,000 years of soil development, of the fungal networks that are underneath the soil that develop, that support that, right? We're now finding out more and more about, like, you don't just get a 500-year-old tree overnight, to put it bluntly. There's a lot that goes in to that ecosystem. So when you log that stand of trees that's 5 to 800 years old, you're not going to get a 500 to 800 year old tree that looks the same or is the same quality necessarily. It's not necessarily just going to come back. We don't actually know that. We don't really know a lot about what happens because we're just finding out now about what is the potential for growing back something that took 800 years to grow. We know that it really is going to depend on the site condition, right? So we talked about before around, old growth in the alpine versus old growth at the valley bottom. There's different site potentials. What is the potential growth of that site is going to depend on many factors, microclimate, soil, all these things that determine how big a tree grows. So when you say, how big is a tree after 60 years, it really depends on the type of tree, the site and that kind of thing. But you know what I find really interesting for people that know parts of Stanley Park in Vancouver or Pacific Spirit Park out by UBC, I often I bring visitors from out of town there and they just assume that that's old growth, right? They'll look around Pacific Spirit Park and say, oh, it's so nice that you have all this beautiful old growth here. Because they see trees that are, a couple feet in diameter. And I realize people don't even know, for the most part, people have no idea what what old growth looks like, because there's so little of it left that's accessible. You really have to go quite far to see, you know, a very large and intact forest. There's remnant little pieces here and there that were left behind. So people can often see, like, you know, a very small few hectares that managed to be escape logging.
Yeah.
Right. And so they get a little glimpse of that. But I've been to
Avatar Forest in Port Renfrew. And I saw the big trees. But if I'm thinking about Stanley Park in Vancouver, I don't know if I can know to differentiate. Would you say that in Stanley Seeds they're not all growth?
There's individual trees within Stanley Park that have been retained that are quite large, quite old here and there. But for the most part, that has been logged, or there's also a lot of wind blow down. About a third of Stanley Park was blown down by a big storm. When was that? 10 years ago? I can't remember. But overall, Stanley Park is not reflective of, you know, what I would consider old growth intact forest that still has characteristics of an undisturbed, unlogged forest.
No bears.
That's right. So when I think about an old growth forest, I think about something that is still reflecting some of the dynamics, the ecosystem dynamics that are, you know, original, that haven't been disturbed. It supports a full complement of species that play all their vital roles in maintaining ecosystem function. It's often looks very patchy. So instead of when you replace, say you clear cut a forest and you replant it with same species and it all comes up in the same age, it's often very dense. A second growth forest, if it's depending on how it's managed, may look very uniform. It may look very dark. Sometimes the canopy is very uniform and full canopy will prevent light getting within that. So you have less things like berry bushes and other plants and diversity that would be at the ground level. In an old growth forest, you have, you know, again, 10,000 years of like just the forest being the forest. And so you've got places where wind has come and it's taken out a big area. So you might have younger trees over here as it's growing up where you know, a big tree fell and it's left a big crater where the root ball gets torn out of the ground. You may have seen that when it falls over, right? You get a big pit. Well, that pit gets filled in with water. It creates habitat for salamanders and amphibians. Where you get trees that have fallen and are rotting, you get this lovely rotted forest. So much of the important parts of a tree's function only happen once it dies, right? So you've got this abundance of rotting, decaying wood that's supporting large populations of insects, which in turn get picked up by the birds, and that reflects the bird diversity. And, you know, we talked about what the industry loves about clear wood is that there's no limbs on the lower, there's no branches on the lower parts. So what that looks like when you're walking through an old growth forest is magical. You have these giant bases of the tree, but it's actually quite open because there's no branches. You can see, you know, quite a long way. And so what that means is species like the spotted owl and the marbled mural, they do very well in those areas where it's really open. Even though you're in a forest, it's quite open still. And you must have seen that in Avatar Grove. Very giant stems, but quite an openness and patchy light that comes through and supports things like huckleberry bushes and ferns. And it's very lush, right? Deep, deep mosses are supported. So this whole thing acts like a sponge, right? You got all this life that's created this sponginess. And so when big rains come, it just soaks it up and holds that water. And so it releases it very slowly. So there's two benefits there. You have the benefit of the water is retained in a way that will make that water available for more months out of the year. There's water coming out of that system, keeps it wet, prevents it from catching fire, makes it less susceptible to all sorts of problems, has that water available for all the animals, all the plants, supports it all year round. And it really prevents the problems with flooding, right? So it's the problems where you have like a parking lot and the parking lot's sealed and the rains come and it very quickly, like, you know, creates this overland flow. Nothing is getting absorbed.
Wait. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I'm from Israel, and in the desert, the soil become just like you're talking about. It's like a rock. And when there is a lot of rain, doesn't happen a lot, when there is a lot of rain, we see floods, crazy floods that takes cars and everything with it. You can't stand there. It's like so deep. And just the water like just running on this rocky soil.
Okay, that's a perfect example. So with an old growth forest, it creates this sponge. So you can imagine instead of having fast flow overland, you have this ability to absorb water as it comes, and then you release it slowly. And it moderates everything in a very nice way that it's not just great for the forest and the forest inhabitants, but it's great for communities too. And we know that in small communities in BC where they've had that old growth forest removed, it really has an impact on how fast that water comes into their system. And it can affect the water quality, it can create landslide potential, it can harm their ability to filter the water, introduces turbidity, so just the disturbance in the water that it's muddied, it's got full of particles. When you have particles in the water, that gives a place for bad things to grow, right? So little tiny suspended particles become an area where if you're a pathogen, like, you know, a virus, bacteria that could get in there and create a home, it's more likely that is started. And then if you have a filter system, right, like say a community that has a water filtration system that's based on, you know, UV light or other systems, it's more difficult to eliminate those bad things in the water because it all the sediment and the particles kind of interrupt our ability to clean the water. So we've got communities like Peachland and others in the interior that are having to spend millions of dollars on new water filtration systems that previously they didn't have to have.
Sorry? And who pays for this? Who pays for this right now?
Exactly. It's right now it's the municipality is paying for that. So eventually that's passed along to the taxpayers would be responsible for paying for that. And in the Peachland watershed, it's a really sad story. You can see from the satellite view, over time, the area that catches the water that feeds that into the town system, you can see it over the last 20 years just disappear, that it's all being logged. And of course, that's going to happen. Like, it's very predictable. That would be the logical outcome if you remove all of the natural ability to filter that system.
So why did the cost falls on the citizen and not on the industries that made money from that?
It goes back to what we were talking about, the power structure, right? We're talking about a system in which the industry has very, very powerful control over how things are determined in terms of who gets the benefit and who gets the costs.
When you say industry, it's a big word, right? Mm-hmm. Who is in the industry who wants to maintain the status quo?
So in BC, it's actually fairly well defined, the forest industry. So because there's so few players, right? There used to be many, many more, but over time, the forest industry has gone towards a fewer number of much larger companies. So when I say for the forest industry, you can actually count them on your fingers and toes. The total number of companies that we're talking about, it is very knowable. There's, I don't want to say that they're all the same because, you know, I'm sure each company considers themselves unique like a snowflake, but we know that they operate with one voice often in terms of their lobbying. The Council of Forest Industries, or COFI, is one of the main voices at the national level, the Forest Products Association of Canada carries part of that voice for not all of the industry, but quite a few of the big players in the industry. So I think you're right in that it is always a little bit risky to try to paint a lot of different entities, paint it with one brush as if they all speak with one voice. But I think that we can safely say that for quite a few of the very large players, we see similar dynamics from them.
And the large player would be the logging companies or the stakeholders or the BC Timber
sales? Yes. I'm when I'm referring to the forest industry, I'm talking about the companies that are in charge of logging.
Logging companies.
Yeah. Yeah. And then from there, there's different levels of integration with the processing, right? So a company may be vertically integrated in that they have not only do the logging, but they do the processing and they are involved in the transportation, the shipping. There's all sorts of different structures within that. But typically what I'm referring to in the forest industry here, it refers to the ownership of the tenure. So, and the control over the logging rights, which in turn may be assigned to contractors, subcontractors that do the actual logging. But really, there's not that many big players that control quite a bit of BC's logging. Yeah.
So there are a handful of people that are running the show here. So when you come to talk with them, or the NGO come to talk with them, or who comes to talk with them about sustainability, what would they say about it?
Yeah, again, you know, this is a very interesting dance that you see. It revolves around the understanding of sustainable forest management. You know, they'll have a plan for a defined forest management unit area. They have very detailed, very lengthy management plans. And what I see is they have increasingly sophisticated language to describe what they do, right? It used to be like there was hardly any management plan. They just went off and logged as fast and as much as they could. But in, you know, 100 years ago, you wouldn't see some kind of big fancy management plan with a lot of acronyms. But over time, there's been complexity in the language that's used in a management plan. There's increasingly complex calculations around, you know, how the annual allowable cut is determined, or the AAC. So, you know, NGOs, you know, environmental groups that want to criticize are increasingly handed these like big documents. Here's a 500-page document to describe what we're going to be doing in this management plan. And it creates a lot of work. It's a lot of work for consultants to create the plan. It's a lot of work for environmental groups to try to read and understand. But there's increasingly this skepticism of like, really, like, what are you talking about here? You know, are you just making things so complicated so that people turn away because they think that they don't understand, or they don't have a forestry degree, so they can't possibly understand. I went and did my PhD in forestry because I wanted to be able to say, I know what you're talking about. I can read a forest management plan. I can read a prescription for a cut block. And if I'm going to have an argument with you, I want to know that I can understand your language and speak your language as I'm questioning your assumptions. So I did an entire degree with that view to being able to understand. And my conclusion after all of that is that, you know, it's more complex and there's a lot of acronyms, but at the heart of it, there really hasn't been a lot of change. We're still logging where it is most financially feasible. They're logging as to the greatest extent that they can. And they often try to bend rules to try to maximize some of the highest value trees that they're able to harvest. They have very complex management plans that show, look, we've got like a 200-year planning horizon, right? And so it sounds great, 200 years. We got a plan for 200 years, and this is how the forest will develop over 200 years. It happens to be that in the first 10 years, we take everything. But over the next 190 years after that, we have this plan of how the trees grow back, right? So trust us, we have a plan. right? That's if you
and
read
they,
between
they
all
do the... send people to plant. So they replant, but they don't plant a natural forest. They plant the trees that grow fast, right?
Yeah, I mean, a forest that's managed in a natural way, that's logged in a sustainable way that leaves full ecosystem function in place, you don't have to plant it. Trees self-plant themselves when you're working in a healthy forest. When you're in a clear cut, yeah, if you clear cut and you take out all the trees, then you're forced to have to plant, right? And it's a whole other conversation there around what about the nature of tree planting and this 2 billion trees program that we're launching. But overall, I would just say that the real problem is that the management plans start with drawing down and eliminating some of the most valuable trees. And then the rest of the management plan, their projection for the next 200 years or whatever it is, sometimes they say 500 years, it's just a model that says over time, these trees will grow back. So it's kind of like an IOU. It's like, okay, we're going to take all of the most valuable trees up front. And here's our plan to restore that over this very long time period. But the way that we know that the industry works, it's like we have no idea if these companies are going to exist 10 years from now, let alone 200 right. years from now.
They work in projects, right? Yeah. They have a project, well, this 10 year, they finished, and then...
Well, there's that, but there's also just the nature of corporate ownership and shifts, and companies buy out other companies, and there's all sorts of consolidation, or, you know, a company may decide, you know what, actually, since we've logged this whole area, we're done. We're going to close the mill. We're going to move all of our operations to, you know, Southeast US or Chile or someplace that's faster growing and with cheaper labor. So we don't actually know if they're going to be around, right? So that's my skepticism. It's like, okay, if you want to show me a 200-year plan, let's do that on a second growth forest, right? Let's show me your plan for how you're going to start with second growth, and I will believe you if you can show me that you will maintain on that TFL, on that forest tenure, that you will maintain that forest cover at a rate that is of low risk to biodiversity loss, that maintains ecosystem functions like water filtration, carbon storage, all those good things, takes care of endangered species, habitat. Okay, you can show me that is maintained, then, and that in the first 10 years of that plan, those values are not compromised. Then I will have more of a belief in your long-range projections of what will happen. But don't ask me to believe that you're going to start by like removing everything or a very high volume removed in the first few years, and then just ask me to trust you that you yeah. will allow that to grow back.
Problem
That's
is
not a good deal.
I hear you. When I hear there is a trust issue, and I don't blame you for that. Sounds like with all those complicated words and all the confusion the industry created around the industry, there's a lot of mistrust, and it's a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of very caring individuals within the system, and I don't want to demonize everybody, but the facts are the facts, right? The satellite images don't lie about where we're at right now, right? Like, we just have to be honest with ourselves of what the state of the industry is, what are the state of our forests are. So long as we're not having an honest conversation about that, we're just going to be talking over each other's heads. And it really it is not helpful. But the thing is, I find that the industry is reluctant to talk about what really is left. Because if people really knew how little is left, I think it would not put them... in a good position to negotiate. They want to create the perception that there's a lot left, because then it makes people that want to stop the logging, it makes them look very unreasonable. So I think it's really important. We have to get down to an agreed set of facts I don't know what that will take, but just force government, industry, First Nations, everyone needs to get to the bottom of how much is left, get a projection for how much longer do we have, and what it will take to make a transition to second growth.
Sounds like you got a good vision for how to solve this problem. And now we still need to build some trust, agree on the facts, be willing to talk with each other honestly, face the painful reality of the climate change, and how much really old growth ancient trees have left in our province.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So the Sierra Club of BC, they asked me to write a report about what we know about the types of risks that are created when logging occurs in different types of forests and how that interacts with the type of risks that we are expecting under climate change. So this was in response to government of BC released a very comprehensive 500-page report that looked at, in British Columbia, under climate change, what can we expect to see happen? What are the health and safety concerns we should be thinking about as climate change gets worse? And so they identified about 15 different types of risks. Some of the more obvious ones would be forest fires and flooding that's expected with more extreme temperatures, more extreme precipitation. But it also looked at a number of other risks as well. And so the Sierra Club wanted to know which aspects of these risks that the government had identified, how does logging contribute to the impact that these risks are going to have? What do we know? What is the best available science? So I did a review of the literature, over 100 different peer-reviewed scientific papers on the subject, and I made some determinations around what would be the implications of logging for these different risks. And so I've identified that about 9 out of the 15 risks, logging will play a major role in how we experience those risks. And I really dug in deeply around the issue of forest fires and flooding and landslides as sort of some of the three that are most affected by logging. So, you know, I think overall what was found, like we talked about before, in the temperate rainforest, we have quite a bit of knowledge around what happens when you remove in clear-cut style forestry, when you remove the cover, you lose that sponge effect and you lose the ability to moderate water over the course of the year. And so a lot of the literature revealed the increased likelihood of forest fire that happens in the course of following logging when you have a, you know, large clear cut that's got a lot of dry debris that's just fuel available now to burn. And it doesn't end there, because in the early stages of second growth coming up, there's quite a few studies now that show that trees that are very small, up until they're a lot older, they will be very susceptible to burning. So second growth, up until they've sort of created their own sort of canopy, they're still really vulnerable to fire. And if you remember last September, we had all those major fires that happened in Oregon and California, and we got the smoke of it up here. One of the studies I looked at said that in the order of about 75% of that area that burned was in industrial clear cuts or like logged areas or very early second growth sort of plantations that had come up. So what we know is that logging does create a lot of risk.
How can clear cut be burned? There's nothing to burn.
So there's quite a bit left behind in a clear cut. All the trees are taken down, often just because of safety. But the ones that they actually want is a smaller number than that. So there's a lot of trees that are cut but not taken. And so they're there
So they become dry.
Drying out. That's right. Right. That's right. Oh. So there's a lot of fuel left behind. There's a general term called slash. I don't know if you've heard of that term, slash.
Yes.
But slash piles will be, you know, all the branches, all the anything that is not taken on the back of the truck is left behind in that cut block. And so that creates a large volume of flammable fuel. Material that's available. Yeah. And there's kind of this triangle for to create a fire. You have to have fuel. You have to have heat. So, you know, when temperature has a factor, and ultimately you need a spark, right? What starts the fire. So fuel, heat, spark. And for each one of those three things, there's a nice diagram somebody made for me in my report. I can show it. So for each one of those three things, the forestry that occurs on the landscape will play a role in how much there is of each one of those three things. So when you take away a very large amount of cover, right, you can imagine how nice and cool it is when you walk out from a hot parking lot and you walk into a forest that's got a lot of cover, right? The temperature goes down immediately, and we're so thankful. So that same dynamic, you know, plays out in the middle of a clear cut. It's much, much hotter, right? It's obvious, but it has to be said that heat plays a role, and that plays a role in how it's drying out the fuel. And in the course of a fire itself, it really contributes to how fast that fire is going to spread if it's hot or not. And so that's fuel, that's heat. And then the third one, the spark. So we know that about there's say 2,000 fires or so in British Columbia every year. About half of those are started by humans, right? And half of them are created naturally through lightning strikes. So for the half of them that are created by humans, those tend to follow the road networks, right? So that tends to occur only where the roads extend, and forestry tends to be the creator of those roads. So it also plays a role. In addition to those big three, I would say another big variable is wind. So, you know, how when you see a forest fire, you know, and the forest firefighter is talking about the behavior of the fire moving, wind is a major, major factor, right? So we know that in a clear cut, wind picks up speed, right? There's nothing stopping it. So the wind speed within a clear cut is often much faster than it would be if it was in the middle of a forest. So all of these things are pretty obvious. You're probably thinking like, well, yeah, of course. But this is what made me a little surprised that in a 500-page report about climate risk, they don't mention logging one time. That is very noticeable that they didn't mention it, to be totally blunt.
Suspicious.
It's a little suspicious. I have questions. There's a lot of people involved. It looks like a lot of very smart people. The acknowledgement page is very long. They involved a lot of people. So I would ask why all of these people did not think to consider how logging plays a role in interacting with some of these climate risks. And so again, the same thing again for flooding. I looked at all that we know about how the rates of stream flow, how that's affected by climate change. And then in turn, what do we know about how logging will moderate that risk? And again, there's a lot of work done on this. And some of the studies I was looking at go back decades, with a lot of studies, even just in the past 10 years, that have reflected on the interaction with climate change. So it's not for a lack of information. There's a lot out there. I spent a lot of time reading and researching, again, over 100 articles. And if you look at Sierra Club's page, I made that available. I put it all in an Excel spreadsheet with links. Anybody can check my sources on this. I'm hoping that somebody will use that Excel spreadsheet because I spent a lot of time researching it. But there's a lot that we can learn from that about what do we know happens when you log a a given watershed and what the risks are for communities. There's a lot we know about that. Like, we're not starting from scratch here. So it's not so much like we're calling for this whole new body of work to be opened up. I think it's more just a call for this science that's available to us to be considered and factored in.
Okay. That goes again to the power dynamic that can leave behind unfavorable information. And that's pretty sad. Last question I want to ask you, if you can differentiate between the clear cutting and the firebreaker, that is also kind of a clear cut. And so what's the difference? Is it only the slash?
So I think it's important to distinguish between a clear cut and a creation of a fire break, which they may use as a way to control the spread of a fire. In industrial clear cut, leaving behind sometimes, you know, 40-50% of the biological material, that fuel that's available in that area, it very much does spread, and that does contribute to the fuel available. And depending on how, there's all sorts of factors that would change things, right? Like how steep a slope, the topography, the aspect, the wind direction, there's all sorts of things that can be different there. But we have seen that where there's a large amount of dead debris on the ground, it can very much spread through a clear cut. In fact, one of the forest managers was quoted as saying that they see some of these old clear cuts that are dry, they see them as a bomb and like that's waiting to explode. So if they see a forest manager sees a wildfire that's approaching a clear cut, they get ready. They get ready for it to be a big explosion of the fire will be fed by this dry debris, and it will be not moderated at all by things like a moist ground that has been sheltered from the sun. You know, some of these areas that they can keep their snowpack for much longer because the snow has been sheltered from the sun underneath the canopy. So, you know, that would be more likely to have like a dampening effect versus something that is a clear cut, or even like 10-year-old plantation that's growing up. It's still very vulnerable, very flammable. Branches are very flammable. We talked a bit before around old trees not having branches low to the ground. Same mm-hmm. thing here in the second growth plantations with very dense trees, all the same age, with the branches hanging low to the ground, can act as ladder fuel. So fuel that will allow the fire to climb up. Whereas in another situation with big trees in a dry environment, you could have a fire that could pass through with the trees like Douglas fir, ponderosa. They're totally adapted to having small intensity, low intensity fires come through, and they still live. In fact, they are adapted to that type of fire. What we get with the clear cutting and then establishment of these second growth plantations is it becomes more susceptible to this sort of catastrophic fire. So very high intensity fire that doesn't just clean out the underbrush, but it will take over the crown and spread throughout the entire canopy. And that leaves nothing behind. Fire can be a very regular part of the ecosystem. Mostly I'm referring to the interior and north of BC here. But even in some parts of the coast, you know, you may find that very, very minor amount of fire is possible. But on the really coastal, wet rainforest, I mean, I looked at one study that found that there was no recorded history of fire in 10,000 years. So some of these systems are not adapted to having any fire at all. And then in the interior, there's some that are more frequently associated with fire, but often at this low intensity ground fires that keep the big trees while having a small fire. And that again speaks to the role of First Nations and cultural burning that plays a big role or has historically played a big role, but then was that practice was restricted by colonial rule for quite a long time. Yeah.
Okay. Peter, thank you so much for spending the time with me. It was so important. I will let you go now. Just a few last words, if you want.
I would love it if people who want to read my report. I've tried to make it very accessible. I've tried to write it in a way that can be very easily understood. But I would say that there's a lot to change here. There's a lot at stake. We have a lot to lose if we don't get this right. And time is not on our side. We really have an urgency here to trying to figure out a solution to this problem. Because if we don't do something actively, the decision will be made for us. And that decision will be to continue logging until we don't have any more old growth to make decisions about. So, yeah.
So what do people that listens know, what they can do?
Make sure that your representative, the MLA, Member of Legislative Assembly, and John Horgan, and Katrine Conroy, the Minister of Forests, George Heyman, Minister of Environment, make sure your decision makers know that you care about this, that you're wanting to see some action on this, that this is something that's important to you, and that you're engaged. I think that's really important to that they know people are watching.
So public pressure and awareness.
Public pressure, public awareness, and really with a view to moving us towards a solution. We're not to be depicted as being just anti everything. We're pro, right? We're pro British Columbia. We want a long-term sustainable industry. We want long-term sustainable permanent communities that are stable. I think really that was important to convey that message. We're not just these negative people. We're actually have the best interests of the province in mind, and with a view to coming to terms with the reconciliation with First Nations people, that this is absolutely essential. We can't pretend like we're going to achieve some kind of reconciliation while we continue to eliminate the remaining old growth forests. It's just not going to be possible.